Last Saturday, the people in our road held a street party, and it was great. We blocked off the road where it's a dead end. We put out tables and chairs and a gazebo. There was a barbecue and a carpet and toys for little kids and a football net for big kids. The sun shone, lots of people came out, and we had a good time getting to know our neighbours over food and drink. It was rumoured there was even homemade sushi, though I can't say I ever clapped eyes on that. Everyone was saying to each other how much we enjoy living in our own little corner of BS5, which we do. It was the best of our local community. And we love our city too. Most of us here this morning live within Greater Bristol. And most of us would say that we love it here. Surveys repeatedly show this is one of the most popular places in the country to live. A lot of other people would live here if they had the opportunity to do so. Bristol is a city with the feel-good factor. And some of you are already on the trail of Shaun the Sheep, our entertainment for this summer. But if we're honest, even the most optimistic of us would agree that it's still a city with problems. If we passed around sheets of paper here this morning, we could all list our ideas, the problems with Bristol. Traffic would probably feature on every list, but there'd be plenty of more serious ones too. There's not enough housing for everyone, and what there is too expensive for many people to afford. We have our share of street crime, even on the streets around this building, and conflict between gangs and racial tension, and occasionally even murder. And when crime happens, it isn't always dealt with by perfect justice. Sometimes the criminal gets away with it. We're a diverse city, but we don't always get on too well. We're known as a city of sanctuary, a place of welcome for new arrivals, which is great, but we know that not everyone feels welcome here. And like every city in the world, this is a place where people suffer. The reason for building a gigantic new hospital at Southmead is that Bristol, like every other city in the world, is full of sickness and ill health. We wouldn't be building hospitals if everyone was in perfect condition. And when we start to think like this, even about a city we love like this one, we start to wonder if there's any chance of a better one. A city which has none of these problems. A city where people live free of need and free of fear is what people have always longed for. A city that is truly great. Whole political movements have been built on that longing. Designers and urban planners devote their careers to create conditions for perfect communities to flourish, with the favoured formula shifting from one decade to the next. But wouldn't it be amazing if there really was a place like that, where diversity didn't bring conflict, where beauty never decayed into squalid ugliness, and best of all, where life didn't terminate in death? Wouldn't it be the answer to all our dreams? Well, the Bible book of Revelation gives us just such a vision, and we read a little of it just now. Let's have a look at what's on offer. Turn back, if you'd like to Revelation chapter 21, page 1249 in the church Bibles. If you'd like to follow where I'm going, though, the words will come up on the screen as well. The big 21 on the page is the chapter number. The little numbers in the text are the verse numbers we'll be referring to within each chapter. Now, this book of Revelation, right at the end of the Bible, is a strange one to many people. It's written in a kind of visionary language called apocalyptic. And parts of it are frankly pretty tricky to understand. But when we get to these closing sections of it, it comes into very clear focus again. This is a vision of the ultimate city. So, here's how it starts. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. John, the visionary, has been recording what he sees, one scene after another, and now he sees this. He glimpses this vision of the future, a new world that will take the place of the old one. That's the first thing we notice about this city that's called the New Jerusalem, that it's new. It belongs to the new age. Everything is different. And as we look around this description, which extends over a couple of pages in our Bible, we see how that differentness works out. We see that this city is a place of perfect diversity. All through Revelation, we keep reading about how people are coming together from every nation, every tribe, every language, every people, gathering together in complete unity. Over the page, we find this from verse 24. The nations will walk by its light. That's the light of the city. And the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. The best of every earthly nation is in this city. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. People from every place and from every background are streaming into the city and find their homes there. And here there is no conflict. There is no racism. There are no ghettos where one group or another is confined. Instead, there is perfect harmony and peace. We can see the city as a place of perfect beauty. The city is visualized in verse 2 as a bride, and we'll come back to that strange sounding idea in a minute, but she is a beautiful bride. If you read on through chapter 21, you'll see the city described as like a very precious jewel, clear as crystal, the streets built of transparent gold. It is all unimaginably beautiful. There is no urban decay in the New Jerusalem. There are no derelict buildings. There is no waste ground. There is no rubbish fly-tipped in these streets. Best of all, we see that the city is a place of perfect life. Verse 4 says, he will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. In this world, we know the dark shadow of death looms over everything. However much we try to ignore it or forget it, the shadow is there. The older we get, the shadow just grows darker and stronger. No amount of positive feeling or wishful thinking can magic it away. Death is real. It's coming. And short of death, we know all too well, life is full of suffering. Life on earth brings mourning. As we're separated from those we love, it brings pain, emotional and physical pain, from the whole range of illness and aging and violence too. But in the new city, all that has changed. The old order of things has gone. In the ultimate city, there are no tears. There is nothing to cry about. There is no pain and there is no death. It's the place of perfect life, perfect beauty, perfect diversity. Frankly, this is a city where I want to live. But the key point, which we've skated over until now, is that this city is all about God. Glance through the passage we've read, and it's very clear. The people in this city are God's people. It is God who lives with them and among them. It is God who bends down to wipe away all their tears. If you're a parent, there will be times when you have wiped away the tears of your child. And your heart will have longed to wipe away the cause of those tears as well. But very often you can't. Well, God is going to do that as well. The city itself belongs to God and it comes from him. It comes from heaven. It's a city that lives peacefully and happily under his rule. One of the great themes of human history is our longing to relate to God, our creator. The objective of the world's great religions is to find the way to reach out to God, whatever name they might call him by, however they understand God, whether it's a multiplicity of gods, whether God is the sum total of human consciousness, or whether God is an individual person. The quest is the same, to know God, to satisfy what he demands, and ultimately to know him and to live with him. That is what religion is all about, fundamentally. And inside each of us, sometimes deeply buried, sometimes closer to the surface, There's this longing for a complete relationship with God. And in this city, humanity's endless longing to perfectly know their Creator is satisfied at last. In this city, we can finally know our God. So, is it real? That's the question that arises straight away. Isn't this too good to be true? Isn't this just a wishful, empty fantasy? You might be saying that to yourself right now. Well, let's think about that question. There's a scene I love in one of the Narnia stories, The Silver Chair. You might have read it. The story is about the quest for a lost prince, and the search for the prince eventually leads the heroes far from the land of Narnia to an underground realm that is ruled over by an evil witch. And in this realm, no one ever sees the sun or the open sky. They live hemmed in by rocks, and the darkness is broken only by the light of feeble lamps. And the witch tries to work her magic on them, convince them that there is no other world. There is no overland, as they call it. There is only this world of rocks and darkness. She says, "You've seen this lamp, and you've dreamed up the idea of a bigger and better lamp and called it the sun. You've seen the roof of this cavern, and you've imagined a higher and wider roof and called it the sky. You've seen a cat, and you've imagined a bigger and greater cat and called it a lion. Aslan, the great king of the world. But it's all merely your imagination," says the witch. And then the wonderful character called Puddleglum makes this response. "One word, ma'am," he said. "All you've been saying is quite right, I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who always likes to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said, but there's one more thing to be said. Even so, suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case, the made up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play worlds. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So, thanking you kindly for our supper, if these two gentlemen and the young lady are ready, we're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think, but that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say. What's the point of that? That it's better to live for a glorious fantasy than to face the real world? No, the point of that story is that, of course, Puddleglum is right. Overland is real. The sky and the sun and the stars are real. Aslan is real. And he knew that all the time. Remote as it was right then, and even as he was being confronted by disbelief, and knowing that gave him the courage and the strength to face the horrible reality of the world that he was in. Well, the silver chair is a story. This is reality. And the ultimate city is a real place. Just because something is wonderful, it doesn't mean it can't be true. Sometimes life makes us too cynical. Sometimes the life we lead, hemmed in by the limitations and the darkness of this world, forbids us to believe in anything outside it. But we'd be fools if we let ourselves be blind to the hope of this wonderful vision. As verse 5 says, "He who was seated on the throne said, 'I'm making everything new.' Then he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' The city is real. just as it's revealed to us in visionary form on the pages in front of us here. And the city comes complete with an invitation and a warning. Look again at the last words we read in verses 6 to 8, if you're following. He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death." Now it's God who is speaking at this point. Who is going to be living in the city? Well, not everyone. The invitation first. If you're thirsty, if you want to be part of this new life, this new city, then come and drink from the water of life. Interesting image. Turn over the page to the beginning of chapter 22 and the image expands. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse. It's an achingly beautiful picture. All along the great avenue in the heart of the city stand these trees, the tree of life. Fruit to feed the people, leaves to heal them. All the hurts, divisions, and conflicts are eliminated. The curse that we know in our world, the curse that dooms us to suffering and death, is no more. And our eyes are drawn to this sparkling river flowing down among the trees from the throne of God, the water of life. There is an open invitation. Life in this city, membership in this city, to be a child of God is available absolutely free of charge. That's the invitation. But there's also a warning. And I'm not going to duck or ignore what verse 8 tells us because it's an essential part of the picture. Membership of the heavenly city is not for everyone. In fact, there is a long list of people who are permanently shut out, excluded by God himself. These words are a description of hell, called here the second death, because it's the death that lasts for eternity. And this is a very uncomfortable thought. It might be a thought you'd like to throw out at once. It might even be what prevents you from hearing anything else. But before you say, "That's not acceptable, God can't be like that, I'm out of here," just wait a moment. This is God we're talking about. And if there really is a God out there, would you expect to agree with him all the time? Would you expect everything he says and does to be convenient for you? Easy for you to accept? What kind of God would that be if he always agreed with you? And if there is a God, and he really is a God of perfect justice, as the Bible says, wouldn't you expect him to deal with evil pretty firmly? And wouldn't you want him to? The real problem with this list of the excluded is that we are all on it. Have a look at it again if you don't agree. I'm definitely on this list. The people shut out of the city include the cowardly. That's me. There's any number of situations I've run away from. The unbelieving. Well, I don't trust perfectly in God, so that's me as well. And liars. Would anyone here like to say you've always told the truth? Always acted with complete integrity? I don't think so. And if we haven't murdered, we've all had thoughts in that direction. And according to Jesus, that's really just as bad. We are all on this list. We've all done these things, each of which amounts to a flagrant offense against that God of perfect justice. We're all offenders, every last one of us, which would put the perfect city out of reach for any of us. That's the real problem. The city is magnificent, but none of us has the right to go in. The invitation looks empty after all. And the answer is that we don't get into the heavenly city by right. No, we can't get in by right, but we can get in by gift. The invitation really is absolutely free. Remember that picture of the city as a bride in verse 2? I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. Don't try and picture buildings swathed in a gigantic wedding dress. Calling the city a bride is a way of telling us something crucial about her. There is going to be a wedding. The city is the bride. And who is the bridegroom? Who is going to be the husband? Well, the descriptions of this couple are scattered through these final pages of the Bible. The answer is that the husband is the man who bought the city and owns the access rights. His code name is the Lamb. Chapter 19, verse 9, the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb. And he added, these are the true words of God. Chapter 21, verse 9, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. The Lamb, the name we know him by is Jesus Christ. He's called the Lamb because for the Jews, the Lamb was the animal they slaughtered and sacrificed to God at Passover time. And Jesus is called the Lamb because he too was killed as a sacrifice. Jesus gave up his own life, and his life was the purchase price of the heavenly city and its entire population. This is what Jesus has done. He too came down out of heaven from God. He came and he voluntarily laid down his life on the cross. And that innocent life laid down satisfies God's justice and buys us a place in the heavenly city where perfection reigns. And we can take up our place there if we will go to him and accept the invitation. It's a gift. The ultimate city is a beautiful vision. Thank God it's no fantasy. It's solid and it's real. It can be our future. The question is, what will we do with the offer? Now, you might be a Christian and you already know all this. You already trust in Jesus and you're looking forward to the heavenly city. That's great. Well, never forget, that is where you're going. You're a citizen of heaven. If you are actively trusting in Jesus and relying on him, your place there is secure. And meanwhile, that frees you up to be the best possible citizen of earth, to go out and love and serve the city we live in now. Because you will understand what this city really needs. The more that our hearts are set on being with Jesus in the new world, the more use we will be in this one. Let's make sure that we are and show the world what it means that we are citizens of the heavenly city. But if this is new to you, or if you've heard it all before but never made any move, then you need to make your response to this invitation, to what Jesus Christ has done. And I'd love to talk to you when we're finished. Talk here, talk over lunch, do stay for lunch, talk there, or get in touch with me later in the week. And if you'd like to pray with someone, whether you'd say you're a Christian or not, and whatever might be on your mind, if there's an area down here, people will be here to pray with you. You can talk over what we've been saying this morning. You can pray about anything that you'd like to pray over. So, here is the invitation. One more time. The Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. Let the one who is thirsty come. Is that you? And let the one who wishes take the free gift of the water of life.